I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one archaeologist and his fight to preserve the petroglyphs of Nine Mile Canyon. Jerry Spangler has spent the past 20 years examining and photographing and cataloging those shallow carved pictures in the sandstone walls. Early on, that work was an archaeologist's dream. He got to wander into canyons that perhaps hadn't been explored in hundreds of years. But then tourists started to explore the rock art, and idiot tourists thought it'd be fun to carve their initials in the walls. And then the archaeological preservation took on a new urgency. 3 years ago, the National Trust for Historic Preservation included Nine Mile Canyon in its annual list of the sites most threatened in the country. Jerry Spangler says the latest threat comes from natural gas companies and the heavy equipment they have rattling through the canyon. I'll talk with Jerry Spangler about saving his favorite petroglyphs right after the news. Here's a fairly simple question. What's it worth to you to keep the price of gas down? A lot of people don't like to see heavy drilling equipment in northern Alaska or in the Gulf of Mexico. But what about an old sandstone canyon in an almost inaccessible part of Utah? Okay to send the drill teams in there? Jerry Spangler argues against it almost every day. He's an archaeologist who studies the petroglyphs or the rock carvings on those canyon walls. Not just a few of them, 10,000 carved pictures. People like Jerry call Nine Mile Canyon the world's longest art gallery. The trouble is that now the canyon's echoing with the steady rumble from 18-wheelers hired by oil and gas companies, and the dust from those trucks, he says, is ruining the carvings. So what do you think? What's cheap gas worth to you? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
20 years ago, Jerry Spangler made his first trip into Nine Mile Canyon. He was studying to be an archaeologist. This was to be his first field school. He knew that the area had been home to the Fremont people 1,000 years earlier, but no one's ever been able to agree on what happened to that civilization or why they left. That's part of the canyon's mystery. What made that first trip in more exciting was that archaeologists had only recently started exploring the area and they'd found this amazing collection of petroglyphs, pictures carved in the walls. So anyway, Jerry's driving towards the canyon, and he really has no idea what to expect.
It starts out in the lush forests. It's green and, stark canyon walls. And said, boy, this is really, really lush and pretty. And then as you go on further, it becomes less and less green and more arid. And then by the time we got down to the area where we were doing the research, it's virtually treeless with a ribbon of pasture land down the bottom of it. And the starkness of it was surprising and a bit overwhelming.
I mean, it looks like desert, or it's got the kind of rock formations that you see in Arizona. What are you looking at?
It's dark red and tan rocks, cliff faces that jut up in various levels. If you've seen the pictures of the Grand Canyon, the same type of look. The canyon is very, very deep. It's over 1,000 feet deep, and it rises in various levels. From the canyon floor up to a high plateau. At its highest point, it's up around 10,000 feet.
So where are you on this first trip? Are you right in the bottom?
We're right in the bottom on the first trip. The lower, 11 to 13 miles of this canyon had never been surveyed by archaeologists. The cowboys had all been down there running their cattle over the years, but the archaeologists had never taken a look at it. It didn't seem like a prime candidate for tremendous archaeological resources.
Does that mean 20 years ago when you were there, you were among the first to see what was there?
We may have been the first archaeologist to see what was there.
Yeah.
And among only a handful of people to ever see it, because there have never been that many cowboys down there in the first place.
Now, the rock art that's apparently such a distinctive part of that canyon. Do you need to be an archaeologist to see it, to find it, or does it jump out at you?
Oh, it jumps out at you. We have documented at least 1,000 sites with rock art on it. Each one of those sites may have a few images or it may have several hundred images on it. Most of those are visible from the road, and the public actually goes in quite significant numbers and travels that the bottom of that road and stops and gets out and looks at the rock art. It's very visible to the public, and it's one of the reasons why it's such a famous area, because it is so accessible to the public.
Now, the only rock art that I've ever seen were the dark kind of stick figures drawn on granite and the Canadian shield. This is different, right?
This is different. It's a sandstone, so it's a much softer stone, and it's much more suitable to the images that might be in the minds of the prehistoric artists who made them. They could use a harder stone to chisel into the cliff face and actually make a very precise image.
So they're all carved. They're not painted on the rock.
Some of them are painted. Some of them are both pecked and painted. They pecked out an image and then filled it in with paint. There's still some of those left. We don't know the reasons why that's the case.
You have to tell me, as someone who had always wanted to be an archaeologist, what it was like for you the first time that you realized you were surrounded by so much of this stuff that had not been seen before.
It was, in a sense, it was overwhelming, because I went in with the intent that we were going to cover a certain amount of ground, we were going to investigate it and document all the sites that we could. And after the first year, we had only moved about a half a mile in that 13-mile section. And I'm so overwhelmed by just how much stuff there is, and wondering if we would ever finish that 13-mile section.
When you talk about documenting, what are you talking about? Photographing, anything more than
photographing,
that?
Photographing, sketching, mapping, documenting exactly what you're seeing, how to find it again. The amount of paperwork that goes into each site can be daunting.
But take me back to just to that very first day, that first sort of couple of hours that you had in 9 Mile Canyon. At the moment when you realized there was this rock art to, you know, your left and your right and ahead of you as far as you could see, what were you thinking?
It kind of smacked you in the face that, wow, this is a pretty amazing place.
Is there one rock wall, one place in that canyon that you've sort of settled on as a favorite for you?
There's one particular site that I kind of adopted as my own. It's a spiral snake figure with a snake's head at the top with two horns coming out of the top of the head.
And where is it on this rock wall? I mean, is it at eye level or way above you? How?
It's a little bit above eye level. The panel is quite large. There's a lot of figures on it, but there's one particular one that I identified with. I had a Hopi elder tell me that it was indicative of journey and wisdom. And so I kind of like that, you know, particular interpretation that he put on it. Whether it's accurate or not, I don't know, but I liked it, and so I kind of adopted it.
When you say spiral, I'm thinking of a line that goes up like a circular staircase. Is that what you're describing?
Pretty much. It starts in the center, and then it circulates outward, and then as the circle wraps around itself 7, 8, 9, 10 times, the line comes out the top, and then there's a snake's head at the top with two horns coming off of it.
How big is it?
It's not that big. Maybe 18 inches, 24 inches in diameter on the spiral. And then it extends above that.
Is it true that the spiral with the snake's head is one that you've actually had installed on yourself as body art?
I gave it to myself as a 40th birthday present when I was old enough to know better than to get a tattoo, but still wanted one anyway.
So it's a tattoo. Where is it?
It's on my shoulder.
All right, just so I get this picture right, it's on your right shoulder or your left shoulder?
I think it's my left shoulder.
Is it a pretty good copy of the one that you see on the wall?
It's an exceptional copy. It took about 4.5 hours for him to do. And, you know, thanks to Bones, he paid a lot of attention to detail on it.
Are you still proud of it, though?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. I was wondering.
I love it.
It was like, you know, a moment of the transition from youth to age of silliness, and you wish you hadn't done it.
I turned 50 in 2 weeks, and I'm thinking, well, maybe there's another milestone worthy of another one. I don't know.
These days, Jerry Spangler studies of the petroglyphs are more than just scholarship. That's because heavy transport trucks hired by oil and gas companies are rumbling right through Nine Mile Canyon, throwing up dust and covering up those petroglyphs. Jerry is now head of an archaeological alliance that's trying to protect the carvings. And so when I'm talking to him, I'm wondering, if the sandstone is so soft and the carvings are in trouble now, how is it they managed to survive 1,000 years of hot, dry winds in the canyon? Jerry says that they indeed have been swept away.
The wind takes its toll, you know, and it does rain, and all of these things are eroding away,
right,
you know, a bit through natural courses. What we're seeing is that now the humans have accelerated the erosion through our own activities. You know, some people will go out with paper and they'll trace these images or do rubbings. They don't realize that's just like rubbing it with sandpaper. There used to be a practice that people would take white chalk, and draw over these images so that it would highlight it for their black and white cameras. So we're all damaging it.
Yeah.
I mean, even the archaeologists that go up to those sites, every person who walks on an archaeological site is impacting it.
Now, this push to try and protect the rock art in Nine Mile, I mean, this is what led you to switch jobs yourself?
I mean, the inspiration occurred in Range Creek Canyon in 2002, sitting around a campfire repeatedly during the course of that field season and documenting these pristine sites that are in nearby Range Creek Canyon. And then at the same time as when Nine Mile is being opened up to industrial development, myself and some of my colleagues are saying what is happening in Nine Mile could happen to a pristine place like Range Creek. There really needs to be an entity that advocates for the protection of cultural resources on public lands, and it needs to be done with sound science. And that was kind of the genesis. That and an awful lot of alcohol around that campfire and complaining and moaning and, well, why don't we do something about it?
Part of what makes this rock art so intriguing is that no one really knows what it means. Is it art? Is it a language? Is it graffiti? I'll talk more with Jerry Spangler about decoding the carvings and protecting them, not just from those big gas companies, but also from modern-day vandals who think it's cool to do some carving on their own. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Nine Mile Canyon in Utah is home to one of the most extensive collection of rock art carvings. In recent years, archaeologists like Jerry Spangler have been trying to figure out how many there are. They've counted over 10,000. People are also worried that the carvings are under a growing threat, and not just from the teams of oil and gas drillers that are already in the canyon, but also from the increasing number of tourists who are visiting. Jerry admits there are times when he just puts up his feet and stares at the art, wondering what the pictures can tell us about the people who lived in those canyons 1,000 years ago.
You know, these are not just images on the wall. These are depictions of things that were important to people who lived 1,000 years ago. And it's fun to sit there and just ponder what must have gone through the minds of the person that made it. You know, what were they like? Who were they? You know, they had families, they had kids, they had dreams. But it's not a language, but it is a form of communication. And mm-hmm. We should recognize that the people who put these images up there on the cliff wall did so as a mechanism to communicate an idea to someone else. They are symbols and figures that they knew that the next person walking up that canyon would be able to see that and know what message they were trying to communicate.
One of my favorite stories about these old markings, I stumbled across on a trip when I was on the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland. The Vikings had come across and carved cuneiform, some kind of figures and letters into the stone there. When archaeologists finally were able to decode it, they were like crude jokes. It's like Bjorn likes the cook, you know, tonight and has before. I mean, is it possible that there's a really simple explanation for rock art, that it's graffiti, or that it's I'm bored, it's too rainy to hunt, let's paint pictures or carve pictures in the stone? Or maybe it's just like, you know, Fred has mountain goat available this week. You know, go down to two streets and turn left. I'm not trying to be funny here, but it could be anything.
Question. I mean, it's a great question, and it probably is everything. I personally believe that the rock art is a depiction of the things that were important in people's minds: birth, death, sexuality, mm-hmm. Food, hunting, the unknown. I mean, all of these things are depicted, and probably a lot of it is the profane, and probably a lot of it is the spiritual. It's just figuring out which ones are which that I'm not so certain that that's possible. I should add, to the Native Americans, it's all spiritual. To them, none of it is graffiti.
Do you ever worry that as people become more interested in the rock art, and as more people come in, drive into the canyon, that there'll be too many, that they could be at risk for some reason?
I mean, it's always a risk. You can love sites to death. You know, most of the damage that we're documenting in there that has occurred over the last 5 years is scratched names and initials. Probably the most annoying incident that we recently documented was actually not in Nine Mile, but in a nearby drainage called Desolation Canyon. A bunch of kids, teenagers, maybe young adults, decided to make their own petroglyphs, and they took these stones and carved images of Fremont figures, you know, carrying an oar and a boat and odd things like that, and they all put their names and dates on it, and the dates on that were in 2006, and so it was something that happened within the past year.
And as the point you made earlier in our conversation about how new and how fresh some of this is, I mean, I would imagine there are places that actually see very little traffic and may be a real sort of dream location for an archaeologist because they're so untouched.
Well, certainly that is the case with Range Creek. There is a large portion of that canyon that was never accessible to the public. It had locked gates at the lower end and the upper end of a ranch that recently passed into public ownership. Sites within those gates are primarily in really good shape. I mean, archaeologists are just astounded by how pristine the archaeological sites are. But just outside those gates, the sites are pretty much trashed.
And you guys have been in the news recently because there's been a push for natural gas development in that area. Is that a problem for the rock art?
Yeah. Natural gas is...
Sounds like that's one of the stupidest questions you've heard.
I think the gas companies hit the mother load in that area because it's full-fledged, full-scale development right now. We're talking... the Nine Mile Canyon Road used to be barely wide enough for one vehicle, you know, one pickup, and it was kind of a remote, isolated experience. Now it's a two-lane dirt road. During the work week, we counted on average about one semi-truck every 2 minutes, with at least that many more smaller trucks and pickups associated with the gas development going by. The problem is that it kicks up huge plumes of dust, and that's dust that's intermixed with the chemicals from vehicles, you know, the antifreeze, the oils, the transmission fluids, and it's even mixed with magnesium chloride, which the development companies put down to control the dust. all of these substances end up in the air and virtually covering the rock art. And in some areas, the rock art is no longer visible because of the thick layers of dust.
Does that mean that it'll never be seen again? Or, I mean, can you wash off those rock faces to see the art?
Well, I mean, those are important questions that need to be addressed through sound scientific research. Are you going to cause more damage by washing it? I mean, is it going to be, in effect, a sandpaper? If you try to wash it, will it erode the images that are underneath? A few weeks ago, we were conducting a survey in an area where we knew some sites had been recorded 15 years ago. And we had the pictures in front of us, so we knew where the sites were, but we couldn't see them, and so we weren't certain. And one of the students, one of the grad students that was assisting me, she got so frustrated, she filled her mouth with bottled water and spit it on the area where she thought it should be. And the dust washed away in her spit zone, and there's one of the figures right where it should have been, but it was totally, you couldn't see it.
Is there anything that you can do to limit the truck traffic? Are you talking to the gas companies? Are they helpful?
Yes, we are talking with the companies that are involved, and some are helpful and some are not. We're in the process of recording sites, and we're being covered with plumes of dust virtually, you know, every 2 minutes a big vehicle will go by, and we have to stop what we're doing and cover our mouths and cover our eyes. The dust is so thick, they call it Nine Mile Canyon powder, or Nine Mile powder. It's like talcum, and it's very white and very fine, and it gets in your clothes and gets in your hair. Your hair is all crusty by the end of the day. Makes it really difficult to take photographs, and you can't keep your lenses clean. I've been through two lenses in 4 weeks.
You said some of the companies are trying to help or interested in helping?
One company in particular we have a very good working relationship with them. They have stepped forward and says, we want to do more than what the law requires. We want to be proactive and help preserve these types of resources.
One of the really interesting things about the place that you're in is that the civilization, the remnants of the civilization that you're studying, they were only there for a short period of time. You told me earlier, what, something like 250 years?
At the most. It could have even been less than that.
And do you have any idea why they left? What went wrong?
Well, I mean, that's one of the issues that is debated endlessly among archaeologists in Utah is, you know, what happened to the Fremont culture? Where did they go? My perspective on it is that it appears that there was this population influx at that time when there was population stress. As the climatic conditions changed and the drought patterns resumed, food supply became the most critical issue, and groups that could not grow enough food may have engaged in violent conflict with those that could raise enough food, that had the optimal lands, and that you see a real emergence of defensive social structure where there are sites which we believe to be very defensive. They were extremely scared of somebody else. So I think there's a multitude of things going on. It's warfare, it's nutritional, and, you know, its environment.
It's funny,
though. I borrow a little bit from everybody's different argument and say you're all right.
Except that when you wrap it all together, you know, the population boom and the lack of, good land to grow food and the fighting over what was left, it's all kind of a metaphor for where we are today in your own struggle to try and, you know, protect that area.
I think it's a great metaphor for what's happening today. I mean, in the West, where water is such a scarce resource, we waste so much water on things like Vegas casinos and watering alfalfa, to feed cows. And yet our populations out here, this is the fastest growing area in the United States. And there's no question that we have exceeded the carrying capacity of our local environments. And if environmental conditions change on us, even marginally, We're looking at serious, serious social consequences because of environmental change. And you look and say, well, isn't this the same thing that happened to the Fremont 1,000 years ago? You say, absolutely. It's learning to live within the constraints of your own environment. And in the West, we have not done a good job of that. So I think some things are, bound to repeat themselves. Yeah, the other analogy is, the fighting over limited resources. What was the most valuable thing during drought conditions? It was arable land that you could get water to. You had access to water and that arable land. You could ride out a drought if you could divert enough water and you could control that water. Well, in our modern world, the equivalent seems to be oil. The limited amount of oil, we fight over it. So I see a lot of analogy. I think the past can teach us so much about who we are as a people today. We have to realize that even with all our technology, we're still humans deep down inside, and we react in the same ways. Self-preservation is a very motivating force in all of us.
Still trying to scratch out a living somehow in parts of the country that might not be so hospitable. What's the quote, those who don't know their history are destined to relive it, or something like that?
Something to that effect. And I think as people, we tend to prefer that more. We keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Jerry Spangler is an archaeologist who works in the Nine Mile Canyon area of eastern Utah. He's also head of the Colorado Plateau Archaeological Alliance that's trying to protect the rock carvings, the artwork, and those sandstone walls. If you'd like to see some of the images of the rock art, and also a couple of pictures of the trucks rumbling through the canyon, you can check out our website and find us at thestory.org. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Yesterday on The Story, I talked with Bill Lobdell. He talked about becoming a born-again Christian and then getting the job as religion reporter for the LA Times. Bill says at that time he figured he had the perfect combination of life and work and faith. But not long after that, Bill found himself covering the clergy sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. He says that it first led him to question his faith, and later, he says, it led him to give up his faith altogether.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm a reluctant atheist, and I keep an open mind. So, I haven't closed off any avenues. I do find myself getting more entrenched in this position. I thought it would be, way scarier, and I would not be at peace with it. At the moment, I'm at peace with it. It's not scary to me. It makes sense. But I'm not a a lot of the Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins out there, though I love their writing and their passion, I'm not a evangelical atheist. I'm not trying to convert the world. And in fact, I wish I wasn't converted, but here I am.
After Bill talked, we got a lot of interesting letters from you. Jonathan wrote to say that several times in the interview, Bill said he felt like he was not a good Christian. I disagree. He has thought more about his faith than most of us who claim to have it, and now he's inciting people to think about their own. Rachel wrote us from Easton, Pennsylvania. She noted that Bill comes to a point where he thinks, maybe you either have faith or you don't. Maybe he's right, she says. I once tried to lose my faith, but I couldn't. And I once got very confused about my faith and what it meant and thought maybe I was losing it, and then it turned out I hadn't lost it at all. I just hadn't understood what I really believed. So I think maybe he's right. Maybe you do either have faith or you don't. Or maybe faith has you. It's an interesting idea. Dean wrote from Los Angeles to say that he's also an atheist who used this as a test. How can I tell the difference, he asked, between God speaking to me and the inner chatter of my own mind? So Dean decided to pray about things that he knew to be false. And then he decided to be an atheist for a couple of days and see how he felt. I felt great, he writes. The earth did not open to swallow me up. My world did not crumble. A weight was lifted from me, and I stayed with it. I also got a note from Alan in Hillsborough, North Carolina. Alan disagrees with my observation to Bill that his disaffection with God must have been intensely personal. It was quite clear to me, writes Alan, that his main complaint was that other people practice their Christianity so poorly. Bill lost faith in a God who allows men to do terrible things in his name. This, unfortunately, says Alan, is nothing new. I only wonder why it received your attention. Why do we not hear the wonderful stories about the ways faith has enabled people to live joyfully, abundantly, and gratefully, lives where miracles can and do happen, and the future is full of hope? And Michael from Beach Park, Illinois, also wrote, he heard Bill and said, I too have struggled with the question of whether or not there is a God. I have thought very carefully over the years and have determined that it is not God that I was questioning throughout my adult life. It was the idea of organized religion. I'm a teacher. Inevitably, my students ask me questions about my religious affiliation. When I explain to the students that I am not religious, their immediate response is, you do not believe in God? I explain that I do believe in God. I just feel that organized religion is not for me. Coming up next, a conversation about traditional marriages that fall apart when one of the partners concludes that he or she is gay. In this case, I'll talk with two people who call themselves the straight spouses, the people who are left behind when a gay partner leaves. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Earlier this summer, Bill Shipley was a guest on The Story. He talked about living in the closet as a senior Coast Guard officer. Bill had also been married for 23 years, and he clearly struggled with how to come out, how to tell friends and family after those years of secrecy that he was gay.
I had everything that everybody would ever want in their life to be happy. You know, great kids, grandchildren, great friends, a successful military career. I mean, I've done jobs I absolutely love to do. I've made differences in kids' lives. But you know, I just wasn't whole. I didn't have me.
In response to that story, we heard from people on the other side of marriages like Bill's, the so-called straight spouses. It turns out there's a pretty elaborate network for these people, and that's where my next two guests met and fell in love and got married again. Their names are Joe and Deirdre Moore. I'll start with Deirdre. Her first husband was a minister, and she had suspected that he might be gay years before he actually came out.
Well, actually about 5 years before he came out, he had kind of started coming out to himself. And there was internet behavior I didn't understand, just online all the time, but I didn't really do any investigating on my own into that. And I felt very insecure in our relationship. I remember at one point just getting on my knees in the living room saying, okay, God, if I'm going to be a single parent, help me do this. But I couldn't put a finger on why.
How much blame did you try and bear yourself? I mean, how much time did you spend saying, is it me? Am I not attractive?
You know, quite a bit. Yeah. Quite a bit of, you know, I'm overweight. Oh, I got to be a better wife. I got to be a better housekeeper. I got to... It was always trying to come up with
a way. I can see it being really hard on you.
Yeah, it was difficult. But then again, I thought I was doing what I needed to do and trying to solve the problem that I couldn't really even say was a problem. It was very elusive and I couldn't put a finger on it. But we were driving home one day, October 2nd of 1999, and he was again talking about, he was frustrated with the ministry and he should resign once again. And not again, but again saying that he should just resign. He had all these issues. And I really don't know where the question came from other than just something popped into my head and I said, do you think you're gay? And he said, yes, I know I'm gay. And I didn't say, well, my first words that I did say were, well, that explains a lot of things. That was my first comment. And then I didn't say much of anything. And he
Who was driving at this point? Was he driving or were you?
He was driving. And he was
crying. Looking straight in.
And I was just sitting there taking it all in. And he was telling me how he'd always known that he was gay. But with our upbringing, basically taught us there was no such thing as gay people, just people with tendencies that could be prayed away, tried away, or married away.
This is the evangelical upbringing that you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Did you feel a sense of relief when he told you that?
Yeah. I thoughts that went through my brain were saying, oh, it's not me. Mm-hmm. And I knew almost right away that this, it just clicked. It made sense. And when we got home, we continued with our conversation, and I looked at him and said, well, you can't have both. I felt very strongly that, you know, I couldn't share someone in my marriage with somebody else, male or female.
Yeah, I wonder if he felt a certain sense of relief when you drew that line in the sand. It's like, you know, it's time to make some decisions here.
Yes, he was tired of hiding and pretending to be someone he wasn't. And there's always the talk of, well, can we stay together? But it became evident to us fairly quickly that we would be divorcing. And often what happens in a situation is a straight spouse gets pulled into the closet. Okay, I'm telling you that I'm gay, but you can't tell anybody else. And that did happen for me, but it was with the idea that it was going to be a very short time because we wanted to make sure before we told anybody else that our children knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And he was pastoring in a church. So he resigned immediately, but we did not state the reasons why.
Deirdre was divorced 7 years ago. She went to a straight spouse support group in Duluth, Minnesota, and that's where she met Joe. A couple of months before that encounter, Joe had reached a watershed moment of his own.
She had asked me to support her and be there while telling our children about the true nature of a previous relationship she had before
with a woman?
We were married with a woman.
Okay.
A long-term relationship. For whatever reason, she thought this woman might pop out of the woodwork and tell our kids about it. And I agreed to do that, but she had never really shared with me the true nature of that relationship, so...
So tell me exactly what you were thinking in Duluth. You were thinking that you're there because your wife is gay and just hasn't come to that conclusion herself, or you're there because she's confused about her sexuality and so are you. What's going through your mind?
There was a lot of confusion on both our parts. Just prior to the gathering, she told me that she was at least bi. And I went back and forth and back and forth and finally decided I really needed to go. I needed to get some clarity and I needed to get some support.
Were you beating yourself up a little bit as well and, you know, thinking, well, what did I do that, you know, led my wife to decide that she'd sooner be with a woman than with me?
I don't think I really did beat myself up about that. A big part of my life was trying to be a buffer between my wife and the world in essentially futile attempt to keep her from blowing up in anger. And I took way too much responsibility for her anger, and it took its toll. One of the big signs that I got from her that really told me this is over was when she, out of the blue, gave me permission to, I don't know exactly how she put it, but to meet my physical needs outside the marriage. And, you know, to her credit, she really believed she was doing me a favor. But in my head, it was just... oh, man, this is really over.
And as I mentioned earlier, it was a support group meeting for straight spouses where Joe and Deirdre met.
I think I fell in love with Joe's spirit and his heart. But I think we were both a little shy about, it was sort of one of those where we kept trying not to make eye contact for the weekend, because it was. And I wanted to respect the fact that he was new at that point, but there was definitely something there.
Now, I'm going to ask the question that I know is on the minds of other people who are listening to the two of you, and that is that, okay, you both come to this support group from relationships that are frustrating, that from relationships that are either over or don't have the physical aspect that is a part of a good marriage. Does that mean you get to talk about sex? You get to talk about the physical side of it, or do you steer far away from that?
Sex is a big topic of conversation.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a lot of, was it as bad for you as it was for me? Or, you know, did you blame yourself? You know, were you told you were too fat, too ugly, too old? That type of thing.
And do you get to laugh about it? I mean, does it get,
does it get
yes. light?
It gets very light sometimes, because often in the marriages that we had, sex was not a topic to be talked about. And so there's that sort of release when you get to be around people and you're comparing stories, and it's kind of like, oh, I am normal.
So did this happen with the two of you? Did you find yourself going out for a drink and having this kind of conversation?
Well, Dieter doesn't drink, so... It was a Saturday of the gathering. Some of us decided to go to a bar. And I realized here I was, the only male at the table with four lovely women who I had just met the day before. And we were having a conversation about oral sex. And it just kind of blew my mind.
You're sort of like, thank goodness.
I can't say I've actually ever had a conversation on that subject with anybody before, to say the least.
What do you remember of that, Deirdre?
Oh, there was a lot of laughter going on, and it was just a very silly moment where we were slinging back one-liners, and I think it was just refreshing to know that what you would like in a relationship, there's somebody who actually wants to give that, and you're not feeling like you're a sex maniac for wanting normal sexual activity with the person that you're committed to. The only partner I'd had up to the time my spouse came out was him. And so I had nothing to compare to and to know what's normal and am I normal or do I want too much or
And so
not.
What are the one-liners? Is it you saying, what is that? Or is it someone else saying, for me, it's been like 12 years? Or
I think Deirdre was trying to move us more towards the dance floor.
Probably. Like I said, I wasn't drinking, so I was in my right mind.
How long was it after that encounter, though? Let me move it ahead. How long was it after that encounter that you guys decided that you saw something in each other, that you guys were going to become a couple?
He wooed me, and he was persistent. I was a little more hesitant because of where he was at with his situation. But the Sunday morning everybody was milling around outside the restaurant we had our last breakfast at, and I was standing there holding a camera or some things in my hand, and he said, "You're going to need to put those down because you need your arms." So he gave me a hug goodbye, and he said to me, which freaked me out just a little bit, he goes, "I just might be hitting on you one of these days." And I just laughed. And of course, by the next Wednesday, he was calling me on the phone.
Let me ask the two of you something that I'm curious about. If you've both been through a relationship, in both cases, that lasted over 10 years, where at the end of that, a spouse says, "You know what, we don't share the same sexual orientation. I have not been honest with you." How easy is it for you to trust someone after that? Here, the two of you getting together, kind of, you know, saying, "Well, we're interested in each other," but I can imagine there's a kind of wariness there, where you don't want to get burned again, and feeling like you've offered all that trust to someone and lost it before and afraid to have that happen again. Is there any truth to that?
My ex-wife has never really been untrustworthy on any subject outside of her orientation. So
my spouse also, I didn't feel, was dishonest with me in any other way other than not telling me he was gay at the time we got married. And I think the person that most straight spouses have trouble trusting after this happens is themselves, because they look back and they try to figure out, well, why couldn't I have known this? And
it was my judgment that was flawed.
It was my judgment that got me into this. And that's really not true. My something very healing that my ex-husband said to me was that I didn't know because he didn't want me to know. And it wasn't because I wasn't smart or that I didn't see the signs or anything like that.
I'm talking with Deirdre and Joe Moore about getting married for the second time. In both their cases, their first spouses told them they were gay and those marriages ended. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. Joe and Deirdre have now been married to each other for a year and a half. I asked them how it's working out, if their behaviors had to change dramatically. I don't know, like getting changed at bedtime.
We got to adjust to the fact that we don't mind being naked around each other. And, you know, in my first marriage, if I came to bed naked, I got kind of scolded.
You're a sex maniac. Go put something on, Deirdre.
Right. What are you thinking? And so that was rather confusing. And it was rather a relief that with this new relationship, none of those things were issues. Just was more natural.
Before, it was everything had to be perfect or shows canceled.
I bet in the same way, and I'm projecting here because I don't know your exes, but I would imagine that they're a whole lot happier having come to kind of public terms with their sexual orientation. Do you see that in them?
I do. When we kind of became the friends we were meant to be originally, and
that was a big relief
for both of us. Yeah, because we definitely have a connection and we have a lot of history. So it's not something you just walk away from. So I always say we're both repartnered. And they had a commitment ceremony at our. We're also going to the same church. He's got a wonderful partner who loves my kids too, and I'm really happy for him.
And how often do the two of you look across the breakfast table at each other and just smile and say, isn't it great that, you know, after those relationships that didn't work out, we're in one that looks like it will?
About every 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
There are many times every day when I hear my wife tell me that she loves me. And that took a lot of getting used to. And, you know, I just hope that I return that sufficiently.
And you do. What I like is that I hear those words and the actions say the same thing. I did get told that I was loved and beautiful and, you know, wonderful, yet dissonance, I guess, between those words and how I felt. And so now the words and the actions all match.
That's Deirdre and Joe Moore. If you have an experience about an unexpected turn in your life, why don't you get in touch with me and tell me the story? You can find me at our website. We're at thestory.org, or you can just leave me a message on our phone line at 1-888-966-9862. Kevin Brown is the man who composed this music that you're listening to. He's also the one playing the sax, and he'll be my guest tomorrow on The Story. Kevin was blind when he was born, but he did get his sight back, and then he lost it again. And it's fascinating to hear him talk about how those experiences affected his music. Kevin Brown, my guest tomorrow on The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.